This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966, Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBLO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Villanderos-Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News. Racial profiling in Oregon, a series of public meetings on the issue draw to a close. The Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta has more of the endangered sooty mangabey monkeys than exist in the wild. Jane Goodall lobbies Congress for their protection. And at least 25 people have been executed gangland style in Iraq's third largest city this week, with residents gunned down in ones and twos and bodies found scattered throughout Mosul.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq as of today, there have been 2,510 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. And IraqBodyCount.org reports 42,889 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. InformationClearinghouse.info reports the true number may be as high as 250,000 Iraqis dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 22nd, 2006. I'm Eduardo de Landeros-Tierra with my radio dog, Cosmo.
And I'm Marlise with Eduardo's radio dog, Cosmo. First story, the Army officially notified a Madras family today that one of the bodies found near a checkpoint south of Baghdad was that of Private First Class Thomas Tucker. Tucker, aged 25, and Private First Class Christian Menchaca, aged 23, of Houston, went missing last week after an attack by insurgents. Military officials told Menchaca's family today that his remains had been identified as well. The phone call to Madras came at 1:30 a.m., said Kay Fristad, an Oregon National Guard spokesman for the family. Army National Guard Sergeant First Class Randall Everett, who has been staying in a mobile home on the family's property, took the call and notified the Tuckers, Fristad said it, quote, "It's been extremely difficult throughout. There was always a shred of hope there," end quote. A U.S. military official said yesterday that the soldiers were tortured and at least one was beheaded, possibly both. The bodies were sent to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware for DNA testing.
Seven members of the Wampum Band of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla visited Seattle today to pray over the bones of Kennewick Man. A museum official says the boxes in which the bones are stored were not opened and the tribal members were not allowed to burn cedar bowls during the ceremony. The members of the Wampum Band and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation are among those who believe that the 93 hundred old bones were an ancestor. The Indians were blocked from burying the bones when the courts ruled that they can be studied by scientists.
The Benton County Elections Office said yesterday that opponents of a new telecommunications tax had gathered enough signatures on referendum petitions to hold a vote at the city election September 19th. The city council approved the new tax last month, putting a 5% tax on all telecommunications services. That would mean a new tax on cell phone companies, which don't pay a tax now, and a tax reduction for landline companies, which now pay 7% franchise fees. Revenue from that source has fallen as people switch to cell phones, city officials said. A coalition of phone service providers worked with the chief petitioner, Brian McElligott, a Corvallis resident, to hire a company to collect signatures. The tax would take effect September 1st, but the city council will meet July 5th to discuss whether to put a moratorium on it until after that. City officials said the alternative to the phone tax is to cut other general fund services such as the library or parks and recreation to pay for the fire department's most urgent equipment and training needs. Industry representatives called for a general business tax, saying that would be more equitable.
Rosie Sizer was named Portland's police chief today and taking over for a chief who was tainted by a scandal over a relationship with a department desk clerk. Sizer was the Southeast Precinct Commander before she was named interim chief in April when Mayor Tom Potter placed Derek Foxworth on administrative leave. She's a 20-year veteran of the Bureau and the wife of former Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Noelle. Foxworth acknowledged a sexual relationship lasting more than a year with the clerk, Angela Oswald, before he became chief in 2003. Some of his explicit emails later were made public and became a scandal. Potter said last week an investigation did not substantiate most of the allegations against Foxworth. This week, though, Sizer gave Foxworth her former position as Southeast Precinct Commander. Sizer also said her goals as police chief will include increasing the openness and transparency of the police bureau, building relationships with the community, and using police resources more wisely.
Northeast Portlanders met with Police Chief Rosie Sizer last evening, recounting personal experiences with racial profiling. It was the fifth of five community listening sessions. They were held in response to a recent report that found minority drivers are pulled over at a higher rate than whites. Black drivers are stopped at nearly twice the rate as white drivers, but when searched are less likely to have illegal drugs. KBOO's Jacob Fenston files this report.
On June 11th, my 19-year-old nephew, who is my adopted son, was chased by Portland police to our residence. I heard him calling my name. He calls me Paula, but I am his adopted mother. I heard him calling my name. I ran to him. I was in the basement coming up the steps. When I got there, he was in the control position on his knees. Taser pointed at him. I lost it. At that time, another officer came from the left and grabbed my arm and put me in some kind of position or some kind of twist or some kind of turn. The officer that had my son, my adopted son, my brother's son, said that he had chased him because he thought he had drugs. This is a boy that has no record. This is a boy that does nothing, very little of anything. He said, go to work. He was getting off of work. He had just got a new job. Anyway, I was written a citation for interfering with the police. My nephew was taken downtown. He was booked, fingerprinted, and let go. Because he didn't do nothing. That's all I got to say.
Paula West speaking to a group of about 80 Northeast Portland residents and police officers. She's one of 12 community members that offered personal testimonies about racial profiling. Police Chief Rosie Sizer said the police bureau is clearly not always succeeding in doing the right thing.
But we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Chief Sizer said that to protect the community, police must use controversial pretext stops. Traffic stops where an officer suspects illegal behavior and uses a minor infraction to pull someone over. A failure to signal or a broken taillight. Recently, such pretext stops have led to police shootings of innocent unarmed drivers. Chief Sizer says police need to find a way to conduct these stops that is safe and acceptable to the community.
You may hate pretext stops, but when those pretext stops are used to close a drug house next door to you, you're going to want us to use them. So how do we do it more finely with better results and with fewer negative results for all of you?
Following the community members' testimonies, police officers and...
We are having technical difficulties, so we're going to go on to the state, to another story concerning the state, the Oregon State Elections Division, which recently told a California company that its method of compensating petitions carriers for several Oregon initiatives appears to violate the state ban on paying per signature. The division initially okayed Arnold Political Consultants' plans for paying signature gatherers, but State Elections Director John Lindbeck sent a letter to the company this week expressing fresh concerns about those arrangements. Arnold's petition carriers are gathering signatures for various conservative-leaning initiatives, including ones to clamp a new limit on state spending and reimpose term limits on state lawmakers. Lindbeck said it appeared that the signature gatherers' hourly pay and bonuses were directly tied to the number of signatures they collect. That would violate the state law passed by Oregon voters in 2002 to ban the bounty system of paying by the signature. In response, Michael Arnold, who's the owner of Arnold Political Consultants, said yesterday the company will bring its operations into compliance with Oregon's law.
A Portland legal group has alerted four timber companies and state forestry officials that a lawsuit is in the works for federal Clean Water Act violations. The Northwest Environmental Defense Center says logging roads are funneling polluted water into Coast Range rivers when it rains. The group, which is based at Lewis and Clark College, has effectively used similar Clean Water Act lawsuits against companies releasing pollution into the Columbia Slough and Willamette River. The group said this week it has water tests and video footage that prove the muddy water is entering the Trask and Kilchees rivers, prime salmon rivers that run into Tillamook Bay. Executive Director Mark Riskedal says he hopes the state and companies will negotiate a solution within the next 2 months, otherwise the groups will file a lawsuit. The Oregon Department of Forestry has documented the problems in its own reports over the last decade.
After more than a year of legal battles, a Corvallis woman who has fought to race with a cane will compete in this weekend's Eugene Hayward Classic. 59-year-old Zell Brook runs with a cane to help with balance problems that stem from a brain tumor. Brook taps the cane down close to her body every few strides when she's running, and so she knows where her feet are and can stay balanced. Brooke has run more than 100 races, and that includes the Portland Marathon, with her cane. She competed in the Hayward Classic in 2003 and won 2 gold medals there and 1 silver medal, too. But shortly after that, she returned for the National Masters Championships, where an official told her just before the race that she could not compete with her cane. But now, under this agreement, Brooke tells in advance what races she wants to run.
Despite the use of private data brokers by federal and local law enforcement agencies, the FBI said today that the company's practice of gathering private telephone records without warrants or subpoenas is illegal. A senior FBI lawyer did not acknowledge whether any FBI investigators sought telephone records or other information from data brokers. Internal corporate documents turned over to Congress by some data brokers include emails in which workers described efforts to impersonate targets of investigations to trick telephone carriers into revealing private calling records.
The Senate rejected 2 amendments today to the defense appropriations bill proposed by the Democrats. The Levin Amendment, which was defeated 39-60, proposed that the U.S. should pull out of Iraq by the end of this year. The second, less popular Kerry Amendment, required withdrawal from Iraq as soon as possible. In the meantime, Military Families Speak Out has been holding a vigil outside Congress to force lawmakers to make the demands to withdraw from Iraq more serious. Anastasia Kaniskaya has more from Washington, D.C.
Today's long-awaited vote on the redeployment of troops from Iraq was again voted down by the United States Senate. Senator Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island was the only Republican to support the Levin Amendment.
To send the word to the insurgents, we're not going to be there permanent, but gives enough flexibility to the administration. It's not shall, the language is should.
Republican Senator McCain from Arizona voted against both the Levin and Kerry amendments. He stated, nevertheless, that the entire country, including the Republicans, is looking forward to end the war in Iraq.
I think most Americans want us to leave, but they're not prepared to have an arbitrary date or condition for withdrawal. Generally in tune with most Americans who are very frustrated but feel that a premature termination of U.S. troops would be harmful. And of course, the Democrats always give us a little bit of a break by having two competing proposals of their own. God bless them.
The fact that Democrats proposed two distinct amendments raised concerns that Senate Democrats are split on the topic. Senator Barack Obama from Illinois disagrees.
Despite the enormous misgivings that privately are expressed by Republicans with respect to the war, for example, the president can call in all the Republicans, give them a book, a manual on how to respond to these issues. It's much more difficult for Democrats to do that. This whole notion that the Democrats are hugely divided on Iraq is completely overstated. I mean, if you look at the differences between the Kerry Amendment and the Levin Amendment, both amendments say we should start withdrawing troops. There are tactical differences.
Still, a number of Democrats voted against the amendments to pull out of Iraq. Those Democrats included Senator Dayton from Minnesota, Senator Landry from Louisiana, Senator Lieberman from Connecticut, Senators Nelson from Florida, Nelson from Nevada, and Pryor from Arkansas. Stacey Bannerman from the organization Military Families Speak Out says that those who vote against troop redeployment are out of touch with reality concerning this war.
These folks in Congress, with the exception of maybe a handful of them, none of the rest of them even have loved ones in the military, much less who have served in Iraq. So they're so completely out of touch with the horror of this war, they're not listening to the majority of Americans. That is not democracy.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The government proposed new rules today that require factory-style farms to obtain permits and set conditions when polluting rivers, streams, and lakes with animal waste. The proposed rules from the Environmental Protection Agency would require owners and operators to apply for a permit before polluting and to attach a nutrient management plan. EPA officials would give the public a chance to comment on it. The rule also would allow the farm businesses to define what constitutes pollution, and it would exempt them from needing a permit if they discharge only agricultural stormwater. Eduardo?
The U.S.-Mexican border is becoming militarized. California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas have become sending National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexican border. And meanwhile, in Tucson, Human Rights Advocate Coalition No More Deaths is teaming up with the University of Arizona researchers to document the treatment of migrants by U.S. Border Patrol agents, as well as other factors that impact border crossers. From Tucson, Patrick Angstrom Poor files this report for FSRN.
The U.S. Border Patrol says an average of 880 migrants have been apprehended every day since October 1st in the Tucson sector, an area running from Yuma on the western border to the New Mexico border in the east. But estimates from other sources say anywhere from 200 to 2,000 are returned to Nogales daily. More National Guard troops arrived to southern Arizona this week, and U.S. officials continue to claim that the troops on the border will not be used for enforcement, only for so-called infrastructure and communication projects, so that the Border Patrol can detain more border crossers. But the Human Rights and Migrant Advocacy Coalition No More Deaths says that failed economic and immigration policy is the root cause of undocumented immigration, and that more enforcement will not reduce the number of people crossing the border. This week, No More Deaths, which has participated in desert search activities and a walk for migrant rights, is launching a new project with Tucson-based academics. Guadalupe Castillo of the group Derechos Humanos, which is part of the coalition, elaborates.
This project calls for interviews with migrants who are returned from the United States at Nogales and Agua Prieta. This documentation will be carried out by No More Deaths volunteers and others who will be meeting buses at these ports. We want to examine the impact of border policy and continued militarization on the fundamental human rights of migrants. In particular, we will look at how the individual was impacted by the basic needs of food, water, shelter, medical care, family unity, physical and psychological treatment.
Dr. Linda Green is an anthropologist also at the University of Arizona who has examined the immigration journey for Guatemalan and Mexican immigrants, and she is currently writing a book on border policy. In her interviews with migrants, she has also gathered testimony indicating human rights abuses.
I've talked to a number of people who talk about the deplorable conditions of no food, no water, no real sanitary facilities, perhaps just a bucket in the middle of the room. People are crowded into a small cell, 20, 25 people at a time. Now, I've been to a community meeting here in Tucson where the Border Patrol was confronted by legal residents who had been picked up and thrown into those detention centers and verified those deplorable conditions.
For FSRN, I'm Patrick Engstrom-Poor in Tucson.
Arizona lawmakers agreed to let voters decide whether to deny more state services to illegal immigrants and whether to make English the state's official language. The Republican-dominated legislature rejected other ballot measures to criminalize the presence of illegal immigrants in Arizona, set state punishments for businesses that hire illegal foreign labor, and stop communities from prohibiting police enforcement of federal immigration law. The two measures approved late Wednesday at the close of a 164-day session will go on to the November ballot.
The House GOP is attempting to alter voting procedures in federal elections. Lawmakers are pushing for greater voter requirement for all people to ensure undocumented immigrants don't vote in federal elections. The move comes as the GOP pulled the 1965 Voting Rights Act reauthorization from the floor at the last minute. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Federal Election Integrity Act would mandate that people show proof of citizenship when they register to vote and a picture ID to prove their identity at the voting booth. Proponents cite voter fraud and the inability to prove a voter's citizenship for the needed requirements. Republican Representative Henry Hyde from Illinois authored the legislation. He says that a large number of the millions of undocumented immigrants could be voting in U.S. elections.
It is a real problem, and the law is that a citizen should vote. Most everybody has a driver's license.
The extent of voter fraud is unclear. Some say there's widespread fraud, while others cite a small fraction. Representative Hyde testified before the House Administration Committee about his legislation. It's illegal for non-citizens to vote in U.S. elections. One could receive a felony conviction and up to 5 years in jail if caught doing so. Campaigns exist around the country to push for non-citizens to gain the right to vote if they lived in the region for 6 months. But only opponents of the immigrant vote addressed that issue. Proponents raised concerns about the impact these regulations would have on millions of citizens. Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas.
This is not just an attempt to, if you will, stigmatize undocumented immigrants or, if you will, make them scapegoats. You are hurting citizens of the United States, and you're hurting individuals who have different backgrounds who you would stigmatize or suggest that they are not a citizen. We need to enhance rights. We don't need to take away rights.
The concern is over people's lack of access to identification. Democratic Representative James Langevin from Rhode Island.
It could be a lance corporal into Crete whose parents failed to include a birth certificate in her duffel bag. It could be the Mississippi sharecropper born in his family home in a county that had no interest in recording his birth. It could be a fisherman in St. Bernard Parish, unable to find a public record of his life in the wake of Katrina's destruction. And it could be a naturalized citizen who, because of a government clerk's error, cannot obtain a copy of his naturalization papers. And maybe it's an elderly Rhode Island resident who leaves her home of 50 years to enter an assisted living facility.
It makes sense to prevent 1,000 legitimate travelers from flying who don't have ID if we can stop one terrorist who will blow up the plane, right? But it doesn't make sense with voting to exclude 1,000 legitimate voters just to stop one possible fraudulent voter.
That was Spencer Overton, professor at George Washington University Law School. The proponents of the requirements urge their necessity. Dan Stein is president of Federation for American Immigration Reform.
To do nothing is to risk jeopardizing the integrity of our electoral system, which is at the heart of our whole republic.
This hearing comes one day after House GOP leadership pulled the reauthorization of the 1965 Voting Rights Act from the floor just hours before a debate was to begin. A number of Republicans protested the measure because of provisions that allow bilingual access at voting booths. It is unclear when the measure would be brought up again, which jeopardizes the quick passage of the bill, in which certain provisions will expire in September of next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The current time is 5:25, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
While George W., the Congress, and the media have us all looking south to what they call the invasion of America by impoverished illegal immigrants, or looking east to what they call an endless threat to America from hordes of fanatical Islamic terrorists, there's another very real but very quiet siege taking place on our people's government from within. Far from being a movement of desperate poor people, this assault on democracy is being mounted by extremely wealthy and powerful guys in pinstripe suits. Theirs is a corporate assault on our public resources, public institutions, public functions, and the very idea of the common good. They fly the flag of privatization, and their goal is to take over our public sector, essentially eliminating it and substituting corporate governance. In an important book titled The Fox in the Hen House, Cy Kahn and Elizabeth Minnick document the startling extent to which this takeover has already happened. Corporate lobbyists, corporate-funded think tanks, and corporate-owned politicians have been pushing privatization, which is nothing but a euphemism for corporatization, for decades, with Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton willingly turning over public purposes, assets, and control to these private, anti-democratic, profit-seeking interests. As Kahn and Minnick show, the privatizers hit the motherlode with the Bush-Cheney regime. With their extremist anti-government ideology, the Bushites are gleefully selling out the public good by selling off whole chunks of our government. We know about their push to privatize Social Security and schools, but few are aware of the massive turnover of power to corporations in such areas as the military, our parks, prisons, and social programs. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help keep our democracy from being devoured by the corporate foxes, check Kahn and Minnick's website, thefoxinthehenhouse.com.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast at 6 p.m. Hear Proverbial Perspectives with Bruce Broussard. At 7, Good Times with the Swinging Reggae Bob. And the weather, it's post-solstice, so that means the summer is starting up and warm and partly cloudy for the Willamette Valley, going into a stunning weekend of 90 degree plus temperatures, everybody. In the Columbia Gorge, it's going to get even sunnier, also in top of the 90s this weekend. You're listening, of course, to the handcrafted KBOO Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and the river.
Senate panel today approved $160 million to pay for credit monitoring for veterans, one of many expected payments as the government struggles with fallout from data breaches crossing several agencies. Meanwhile, a House panel was cautioned that credit monitoring alone may not be enough to protect millions of veterans and nearly all active duty military, guard, and reserve members whose names, birth dates, and Social Security numbers were taken May 3rd from a Veterans Affairs employee's home. Earlier this month, Health and Human Services Department discovered that personal information for nearly 17,000 Medicare beneficiaries may have been compromised when an insurance company employee called up the data through the hotel computer and then failed to delete the file.
The Bush administration suggested today that it has limited ability to shoot a North Korean missile out of the sky and spurned suggestions of a preemptive strike on the ground. Still, the U.S. warned the Koreans would pay a cost for a missile launch. The solution, said National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, is for the North to give it up and not launch the long-range missile that the U.S. believes is being fueled and prepared. Missile defense experts disagreed on current U.S. ability to destroy such a missile once it's fired, but they seemed in agreement that shooting at it and missing it would be a huge embarrassment on top of everything. The missile defense system, which now includes advanced radar and interceptor missiles based in Alaska and California, for example, has suffered repeated test failures since the Bush administration ordered the program accelerated in early 2001. Some $91 billion have been spent over the past two decades on this program, first proposed by President Reagan, according to congressional auditors.
The Bush administration will have to explain why it thinks it can ignore and overrule laws passed by Congress in a hearing next week. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter said yesterday. Specter, a Pennsylvania Republican, said he hoped to force the Bush administration to reduce its use of, quote, signing statements, end quote, memos that reserve the right to ignore laws if the president thinks they impinge on his authority. A Justice Department official is scheduled to testify at a hearing on signing statements next Tuesday. Bush has signed at least 750 such memos since taking office in 2001, according to the Boston Globe, more than previous presidential administrations combined. Bush has used signing statements to signal that he might bypass a ban on the torture of U.S.-held prisoners and ignore new provisions in an anti-terrorism law that called for increased congressional oversight.
Representative Bob Nade told Senate investigators he made no effort to help a client of disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff despite extensive evidence to the contrary, according to a congressional report today. Nade said he was not even familiar with the Tigua tribe of El Paso, Texas, which was seeking legislation that would allow it to reopen its shattered casino, according to the Senate Indian Affairs Committee report on the massive lobbying fraud perpetrated on the Indian tribes by Abramoff and others. Yet, the report says Ney assured tribal leaders of his support for the legislation on two occasions in 2002, once in person and once again via telephone.
Was Karl Rove indicted for leaking CIA operative Valerie Plume's identity to news reporters, or was he not? Investigative reporter Jason Leopold is the investigative reporter on this story, working for truthout.org. As Rove's attorney last week announced that no indictment has been made, a chorus of criticism went up around the country against Leopold and Truthout senior editors. Leopold speaks tonight at 7:30 at Powell's Books. KBOO's Lisa Levin caught up with a reporter earlier this week.
This is from truthout.org. This is the senior editors of truthout.org giving background information about this burgeoning and growing issue of the Karl Rove indictment story. On Tuesday, June 13th, when the mainstream media broke their stories that Karl Rove had been exonerated, there were frank discussions amongst our senior editors about retracting our stories outright. The problem we wrestled with was, what exactly do we retract? Should we say that Rove had not, in fact, been indicted? Should we say that our sources provided us with false or misleading information? Had Truthout been used? Without a public statement from Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, we felt it was premature to retract our report. After spending the past month retracing our steps and confirming facts, we've come full circle. Our sources continue to maintain that a grand jury has, in fact, returned an indictment. Our sources said that parts of the indictment were read to Karl Rove and his attorney on Friday, May 12, 2006. Last week, we pointed to a sealed federal indictment, case number 06-CR-128, which is still sealed, and we are still pointing to it. During lengthy conversations with our sources over the past month, they reiterated that the substance of our report on May 13, 2006 was correct, and immediately following our report, Karl Rove's status in the CIA leak probe changed. In summary, as we press our investigation, we find indicators that more of our key facts are correct, not less. Jason, what the hell's going on?
Great question. Well, clearly what is happening is there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that simply beg for more reporting. And sadly, very sadly, and this should be an example of the failure of mainstream American journalists to really dig into this story. You know, in terms of what is happening with this and why the senior editors of Truthout, which by the way is, you know, it just even though it's an online publication, there's a full fledged staff there of people that have experience, a lot of experience in journalism.
And all the senior editors of Truthout also were working on this story with you.
Exactly, and you know what is taking place or what took place behind the scenes. We don't have the full details of that yet, but having spent countless hours over the past 5 weeks since we reported this story and putting the pieces together and speaking with our sources, speaking with them at length, having the senior editor speak with them at length, you know, we have come to the conclusion that without a public announcement by Patrick Fitzgerald, without any documentary proof, certainly without any tangible evidence that suggests that, you know, our story is in fact 100% wrong, it is premature to say that Karl Rove is wasn't indicted, that there wasn't a deal happening, that he wasn't cooperating. Certainly would be premature to retract anything.
Got
to
jump in here.
Sure.
For the record, the Truthout's editors did contact a spokesperson for Patrick Fitzgerald and asked her these questions. Did a grand jury return an indictment of Karl Rove? Did Patrick Fitzgerald send a fax to Robert Luskin similar to that described in recent press reports? Is Patrick Fitzgerald's probe of the Plame matter still ongoing? Her response, I have no comment. I mean, she didn't say Karl Rove was
right.
Not indicted. I've never seen a story like this, Jason.
Yeah, I have to tell you that in all of my experience and all my years working as a journalist, you know, good times and the bad, I have never, ever experienced a more bizarre drama, mystery, that is this Karl Rove story. And obviously saying that because I'm not only reporting the story, I am the story.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with investigative reporter Jason Leopold. Jason has been investigating the Karl Rove indictment, and he will be speaking this evening at Powell's Books on Burnside at 7:30.
The Congressional House has voted to slash taxes on inherited estates. The vote of 269 to 156 would also exempt many more estates from taxation over the next 10 years. The estimated cost of the House bill is $283 billion over the next 10 years. The bill cuts the top tax rate on estates to as low as 15%.
Just two Arab countries have supplied almost 50% of California's imported oil over the last 5 years, a dependence that leaves the state more vulnerable than the rest of the country to disruptions in the world oil markets. The finding, based on an analysis of state and federal crude oil import statistics, underscores the challenge confronting both California, the biggest gas-consuming state in the U.S., and the country as a whole. Meanwhile, lawmakers grapple with consumer outrage over high prices at the pump and a U.S. deficit that has widened on the back of high crude prices. Between 2001 and 2005, Saudi Arabia and Iraq provided an average of 49.6% of all the imports arriving in California, according to California Energy Commission figures. Although still the fourth largest domestic producer of crude in the United States, California fields have been declining at a rate between 2 and 4% each year, with production now averaging about 700,000 barrels a day.
New research finds the Earth is now the hottest it's been in 2,000 years, and it says you can blame all of us. A National Academy of Sciences report finds that in the Northern Hemisphere, an average global surface temperatures climbed about 1 degree in the 20th century. The experts believe the warming seen in the last few decades is unprecedented over the last 1,000 years. The report was done for the chairman of the House Science Committee, who hopes it registers with people questioning whether global warming is still a major threat. The White House maintains, however, the threat isn't severe enough to warrant new pollution controls, which it says would cost 5 million jobs.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is checking whether thousands of families in Mississippi and Louisiana are eligible for the government-issued trailers they're living in, but officials have stepped back from evicting hundreds of the families. In Mississippi, FEMA sent out so-called termination notices to around 500 of the 3,000 families the agency suspected were ineligible for the trailers intended for people displaced by Hurricane Katrina. Those letters mailed in late April and early May notified families they had 30 days to vacate their trailers and 60 days to appeal the agency's ruling. However, Bresnay said the agency has stopped mailing those notices and the deadlines for families to vacate trailers no longer applies. Instead, FEMA is meeting individually with families to determine whether they are eligible for emergency housing or must move out of their trailers and find more permanent housing.
The Supreme Court clamped down today on defendants who claim they were coerced into breaking the law. Those defendants, not prosecutors, have the burden of proving in trials that they committed crimes only under duress. And although the ruling involves federal prosecutions, it leads states to change their laws. The court's liberals were split in the 72 ruling against a Texas woman who claimed her abusive boyfriend forced her to illegally buy him guns while his accomplices held her children hostage. The government lawyers argued that a ruling for Keisha Dixon would help drug carriers and others avoid prison, claiming they were coerced. Justice John Paul Stevens, considered the court's most liberal member, wrote the opinion and was joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, former women's rights lawyer, a lineup that surprised some.
Primate expert Jane Goodall and 18 other researchers sent a letter to federal officials urging them to oppose an Atlanta Research Center's proposal to do AIDS-related research on sooty mangabey monkeys. The letter urges the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reject a request by the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, according to a copy filed with the government. Scientists at the research center have performed research on a group of the primates, which are natural carriers of a form of the AIDS virus, but don't get sick from it since the late 1960s. Federal officials listed them as endangered in 1988, leaving the center with the world's largest collection of captive sooties, but little hope of scientific benefit for the primates in their natural habitat.
Utah State agriculture officials are tracking down 1,000 baby geese and ducks for destruction. The baby birds escaped from shipping containers and were distributed to new homes throughout Utah without being tested for disease. A state veterinarian says about 90% of the geese and ducks have been located. He says because it's impractical to submit each chick to a battery of tests, they must be returned to their original owner or destroyed. State officials say the agriculture department is having the animals euthanized for the interest of public health and animal health. They say the risk of diseases such as avian flu and salmonella is just too great to take any other action.
Tony Blair's government has brought in a number of new laws that carry the potential to restrict demonstrations in Britain. As Naomi Fowler reports from London, an old law is being used by British police at an unprecedented rate, which targets the placards used by protesters.
Section 5 of the Public Order Act makes it an offence to use threatening, insulting or abusive words or behaviour or disorderly conduct, or to display any writing, sign or other visible representation which is threatening, abusive or insulting. Protesters are now finding themselves in legal hot water by publicly displaying that which has moved them to demonstrate in the first place.
We certainly don't do anything threatening when we're on a protest, and that would be completely contradictory to our aims, which is to raise awareness and to get public opinion on our side.
Joe Moody is part of a group demonstrating outside Vodafone shops against their funding of animal experiments at Oxford University.
We just stand there, we show our posters, we hand out leaflets. People who may be customers of Vodafone, they have the right to know what the company they're buying from is up to.
These demonstrators display posters depicting legal animal rights experimentation in the UK. Demonstrator Keith Richardson.
There have been 16 arrests so far for these demonstrations. I've been arrested four times. For a breach of Section 5 of the Public Order Act, a precondition is that your behaviour or pictures that you show should be threatening, abusive or insulting. And we're clearly not doing that. We're educating the public, we're informing the public. We have an argument about that, and then we get arrested. That's what happens.
So far, nobody has been charged with any offence relating to these arrests. Once in the police station and they have to start writing their statements and gathering together the evidence, they realise they don't have enough evidence to charge us because the offence has not been committed.
Criminal defence lawyer Malcolm Fowler.
Civil libertarians like me often muse as to who is actually causing the harassment and alarm. The dignified protesters perhaps upsetting people, making them uncomfortable by images that they want to forget about, or the police going in over the top and distressing and alarming everyone in sight. It's stretching the envelope of the original Section 5 Public Order Act procedure, and when that particular provision was going through Parliament, I don't imagine that anyone imagined for a moment that it would have to do with this sort of activity. It's a very handy, low-key tool for the state to close down activities that they find uncomfortable. That sort of uncomfortable protest is the lifeblood of any worthwhile society.
Protester Joe Moody again.
The pharmaceutical industry is very powerful in this country. Animal research is worth a lot of money to the economy. There's been a lot of successful animal rights campaigning over recent years. Multinational companies getting worried about the amount of protest activity in Britain, and they are putting pressure on the British government. The regional police forces are being instructed by the government to crack down on animal rights activity. The chiefs in the regional police forces are telling their men on the streets to arrest animal rights people.
These protesters are now seeking a judicial review, where they hope to show that police are acting unlawfully, contravening their rights to freedom of expression under the Human Rights Act. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Somalia's foreign minister and a representative of the faction that controls the country's capital signed an agreement today that calls for an immediate ceasefire and confers mutual recognition of the warring parties. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Amir Moussa, said the UN-backed government recognizes the reality and existence of the Islamic Court, Moussa said. The Islamic Court, which groups moderate Muslims as well as fundamentalists, captured Mogadishu earlier this month after sporadic fighting with an alliance of warlords that had gone on for months and killed hundreds of people.
The United States was eliminated from soccer's World Cup today with a 2-1 loss to Ghana. The game capped a disappointing tournament for the Americans, who failed to advance past the group stage. Today's game was decided by a penalty kick. Such things will happen in soccer, but KBOO's Abe Proctor thinks there's something else afoot.
There are several reasons why the United States men's team was eliminated from the World Cup with a 2-1 loss to Ghana. Mostly, it's about the Americans' lack of offense, the failure of its superstars to show up, and its long stretches of uninspired play. But I think there's another, more subtle reason: American foreign policy. I'll get to that in a moment. The United States came into this year's Cup with high expectations after a surprise run to the round of eight in the 2002 tournament. But the Americans sleepwalked their way through their first game against the Czech Republic, who ended up spanking us 3-0. The U.S. team looked listless and not ready for prime time. But the Americans showed up ready to play in the second game, playing the mighty Italians to a draw with only 9 men on the field in a display of grit and fire. And after losing to Italy in their opening match, the surprising Ghanaian side pounced on the Czechs in their second game, winning 2-0. Now, Every team in the group had a stake in the final game. Only Italy was guaranteed a spot in the round of 16, but wanted to win anyway to avoid being fed into the Brazilian meat grinder in its next match. Every team in the group could advance with a win. But here's the thing. After two games, the U.S. had yet to score a solitary goal. The lone score in the 1-1 tie against Italy was a gift from Italian defender Christian Zaccardo, who hooked the ball into his own goal. It's hard to win when you can't score. And Ghana, playing inspired football, drew first blood against the U.S. in the 22nd minute. Midfielder Haminu Drumani picked American captain Claudio Reyna's pocket just outside the American penalty area and drove toward goal, beating goalkeeper Casey Keller with a dipping shot. Now, the Americans needed to break their scoring drought in a big way. And they did, in the 43rd minute. And what a goal it was. The much-maligned DeMarcus Beasley made a quick steal at midfield and went on a streaking run down the left side. He sent a perfect cross right onto the right boot of Clint Dempsey, who sent a laser beam into the far corner of the net. Immediately, the momentum changed. The Americans could come back and win this game. This was World Cup football. And then, right at the end of the first half, two things happened in rapid succession. First, a mistake. And then, the worst call of the entire tournament. American defender Carlos Bocanegra tried to head the ball clear, but instead sent it looping into his own box. His teammate, Oguchi Onyewu, rose to meet the ball along with Ghana's Razak Pimpong. The two players bumped bodies as they strained skyward, and Onyewu won the ball. But Pimpong collapsed when he landed, and German referee Marcus Merck blew his whistle. Foul on Onyewu, penalty kick for Ghana. Now, soccer is a contact sport. Players routinely collide during the run of play, and reasonable contact is accepted as part of the game. The replay showed nothing more than both players going for the ball and bumping into one another. Far more flagrant plays have gone unpenalized in this very World Cup. But now, Ghana had a chance to take the lead. Captain Stephen Appiah, ice in his veins, rifled the penalty past Keller, and Ghana was on top, 2-1. And that's how Rumsfeld lost us the World Cup. Let me explain. It's no secret that the United States isn't very popular these days. Our immense reservoir of post-war goodwill has been squandered in 6 short years of imperial muscle flexing. An illegitimate and deadly war, the torture of detainees at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, the resurrection of secret Soviet-era prisons, the wholesale plunder of Iraq, the withdrawal from the Kyoto Accords, and the strong-arming of the United Nations have all combined to change the world's perception of us from a champion of democracy to the big kid that nobody wants to play with. So I'm forced to wonder, what flashed through Marcus Merck's mind when he called that penalty? Did anger at the bellicose Americans bubble through his brain, firing the series of neurons that expelled the breath from his lungs and through his whistle? Personally, I love the World Cup precisely because it's not political. It's just our boys out there trying to win. The angst of witnessing Bush's America can be laid aside, and I can feel fiercely, unabashedly patriotic. But for much of the planet, football has always been a blank slate onto which nations project their hopes, their fears, their rivalries. It's hard for us in the United States to understand how much the World Cup has come to mean to most of the world. And for a host of countries, it's an arena where they can prevail over the world's lone superpower. We'll never know whether Marcus Merck's whistle blew an anti-American note. But I think it's safe to say that these days, the United States isn't likely to get the benefit of the doubt. To be fair, We didn't deserve to advance this year, hanging around in the World Cup. But in the 45th minute, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 22nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, call us. We're at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA. In Hood River, we're at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our AP Wire editors are GD West and Crystal Lady.
Tonight's audio editor is Josh Johnson. Special thanks to reporters Jacob Benson and Abe Proctor. Our engineer is also Josh Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Eduardo de Landerostiere with Radio Dog Cosmo. And